We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The United States has about 65% of the world's leading universities. However, our guest for this hour of Focus, Columbia University professor Jonathan Cole, says that very few people in this country really understand how these universities contribute to the quality of their lives, and he wants people to know about the considerable threats that face higher education today. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Jonathan Cole about some of the ideas that you will find in a recently published book that he's authored. The title is The Great American University, Its Rise to Preeminence, Its Indispensable National Role, and Why It Must Be Protected. It's published by Public Affairs Books. It has just recently come out, so certainly you can find it in the bookstore. A lot of people in the world of education know Jonathan Cole. He was, for 14 years, the provost and dean of faculties at Columbia University, and he's still there at Columbia. He's currently the John Mitchell Mason Professor of the university. He's also an elected member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the American Philosophical Society, and he's joining us this morning from there, from New York, and we're pleased that he could spend some time talking with us. Now, for people who are listening, certainly comments and questions are welcome. If you'd like to call in, the number to use, actually there are two. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana where we are, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. So if it would be a long-distance call, you can use that number and we'll pay for the call. And that is 800-222-9455. You may also email your comments to will-talk@illinois.edu. It will help us if you do that to try to keep them brief. In any case, we do ask people to try to keep their comments brief so we can accommodate as many different callers as possible. But certainly we welcome people into the program. So again, locally, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And email will-talk@illinois.edu. Professor Cole, hello.
Hello. It's great to be with you this morning, David.
Well, we certainly appreciate you giving us some of your time. And I know that this certainly is a subject that here on this campus, as is the case, I'm sure, many other colleges and universities across the country, these are the things that people are very, very concerned about as they look at their financial situations, their state budget situations, and they think about the future of their universities and what things are likely to look like maybe in the next couple of years, certainly maybe the next 5 years to 10 years. And I think that there seems to be a lot of worry out there.
Well, I think there's just cause to be worried about the state of these great American universities, including places like the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana. It's one of the great universities in the world. I certainly could, talk a little bit about what I think those threats are, but I hope that the audience would understand that what I think people need to know about these universities is that they contribute to the national welfare in many ways that people do not think about. We tend as individuals to think of universities in terms of undergraduate education and the transmission of knowledge, which is a critical function of these universities without any question. But what probably makes them the most distinguished in the world is not so much the undergraduate education that they produce, which after all is done very, very well by liberal arts colleges in the United States and universities around the world, but the production of new knowledge that really transforms our lives and the lives of other people around the world. For example, I think that when most people think about great universities, they don't think about that lasers or the FM radio or magnetic resonance imaging, the global positioning system, barcodes, scientific agriculture, transistors, improved weather forecasting, cures for childhood leukemia, or pap smears, for example, or even concepts like the self-fulfilling prophecy or or human capital. These are all discoveries, inventions that have been produced at these great universities that have led to changes in all of our lives in important ways.
This invites the question why it is the case, as you argue, that so many people, so many Americans, fail to appreciate the ways in which major research universities have developed ideas and technologies that really touch their lives and have improved their lives. Do you think that that universities, and maybe we would include ours, have not done the job that they could or should in telling their own stories?
Oh, I think we fail miserably at telling the story of why these universities are so distinguished and why the public ought to really support them and defend them against attack. We have concentrated our focus of attention, understandably, on the problematics and the problems that we find with undergraduate education. The reason for that is that, of course, most people, when they think about colleges and universities, think about their own children, about their grandchildren, about where they might like to go to school. And that is the real focus of their attention. They are interested in the cost of higher education. They want to know why it can't be brought down. But they don't tend to think about the other missions that the universities have, perhaps the foremost of which is to create new ideas, new discoveries that will transform America. When the United States entered into a compact with the universities and were willing to give them a fair amount of autonomy, they expected at least two things in return: an educated workforce, an educated citizenry that could participate in democracy, and also a set of discoveries that would transform America, that would improve the economic lives of our people, not only the social welfare of their lives, but the economic welfare of their lives, the aesthetic aspects of their lives as well. And the universities have been intent upon delivering on that part of the bargain. The focus has been on the transmission rather than the creation of new knowledge. We have not done well in getting the message out about what great universities actually produce and how it has had both an economic impact on their lives as well as on the social benefits and social welfare that are a part of their lives.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, even just to take it a step further, whether you think that part of the problem has been that to date that at some people at some universities have felt that this business of marketing themselves, or at least putting the word out there about what it is they're doing, was kind of beneath them.
Well, I think there is some of that. There is a tendency in historically at American universities to disengage themselves from the society, thinking that somehow they're an institution apart from society. And I argue that, in fact, they are very much deeply embedded in society. They can't remove themselves from society. They have to interact with not only the citizenry, but obviously the legislative leaders and the representatives in government. We are so strongly linked to the states and the people's wishes that we have to engage them. We can't any longer think that we are ivory towers removed from the broader society. And we just have to tell our story, and we have to tell why we think it's important for Americans to support us.
And is there also some way in which in the past perhaps universities didn't have to be engaged in this quite so much, because if individuals, if citizens really didn't appreciate universities, at least lawmakers, people in government did, and that it wasn't so demanding for universities to make the case that public money should go into these research efforts, and that over time that has changed. And perhaps, you know, if you talk about the people that you need to persuade, we're not just talking about your average citizen. We're also talking about people who are in the Congress and people who are in the state houses across the country.
Well, I think you're quite right about that. I think universities have become much more complex in the last 60 years. After all, you know, the government really wasn't supporting, at least the federal government was not really supporting major research universities until after the Second World War. And it was a very conscious decision to use taxpayer dollars to support the development of discoveries and ideas at these universities that came out of the Second World War. In fact, one of the hallmarks of the American educational system is the fact that the government basically outsources the research that is done for the public good, but it does so through the universities and colleges of the nation. And, of course, NIH and the National Science Foundation, they fund on a competitive basis the highest quality proposals, whether they're at Columbia or whether they're at the University of Illinois or the University of California. And that has, therefore, made congressmen very much aware of what goes on at these universities, but not necessarily as, shall I say, as enlightened as we might hope. That certainly has been the case as well at states, state legislators, and state governments. So it is incredibly important, in fact, that universities make known what is coming from them to these representative leaders, both at the state and federal level. And I don't think we've done as good a job as we might at that as well.
You know, I also wonder to what extent the fact that people are competing for a shrinking pot of dollars when it comes to funding research. And so for that reason that within individual disciplines, people are competing for money, perhaps on individual campuses, different departments are competing for money. And that has undercut the notion that the university is a community as a whole and that somehow we're all working towards a common goal. That if people are really struggling and fighting with each other for what little research money there is, what does that do to the notion of community on the campus and the notion of collegiality among the faculty?
Well, I think it's a very good observation. I think that over time, what we have seen in American universities is a movement from a much more ecclesiastical model where there was a sense of allegiance to a particular institution. That has been transformed into much clearer allegiance to one's discipline and even to one's own laboratory. We are working in a world now of academic free agency that's akin to the kind of free agency that we find in sports. So it's a highly competitive system. It's one in which scientists and scholars are competing for research funds. And this tends to reduce the levels of social cohesion in the university, in the faculty, and that causes certain kinds of problems at universities when we can no longer find the uni in the university. So I think you're quite right in observing that this competition, which, by the way, I believe is very good for American higher education, it leads to the overall advance of knowledge being more rapid, and it also leads to the development of new fields and new ideas. So I think the history of the university in the United States, especially the great universities, has been in one in which there's been actually quite a bit of fierce competition, not only for resources, but for the people who can be highly creative. And we see that in universities today in abundance.
We are talking this morning in this hour of Focus 580 with Jonathan Cole. The subject is what you will find in his recent book, The Great American University. We'll talk more in just a moment. I do want to bring people who are listening here up to date on a state news story that we have been here following. Comptroller Dan Hynes has now conceded in Illinois' Democratic primary race for governor, giving the party nomination to Governor Pat Quinn, who had already declared victory. Spokesman Matt McGrath says Hynes called Quinn to concede this morning. Hynes had refused to bow out of the race the day after Tuesday's primary, saying that he was going to hold on until every vote was counted. Hynes had trailed his rival for the Democratic nomination by a few thousand votes Tuesday, and Quinn's lead has grown as more ballots have been counted. With the Democratic race decided, the spotlight does now remain on the Republicans, who have also been waiting for a primary winner to emerge in the governor's race. I'm sure as the day goes on and there is more on this, we'll bring it to you as part of our news coverage here throughout the day. And this is Focus 580, our morning talk program. Again, our guest is Jonathan Cole. He served for a number of years as the provost, dean of faculties at Columbia University, and currently is the John Mitchell Mason Professor of the University. He's the author of the book, The Great American University, the subtitle, Its Rise to Preeminence, Its Indispensable National Role, and Why It Must Be Protected. It's published by Public Affairs Books. And for people who are listening, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And you may also email your comments to will-talk@illinois.edu. I think that it might be interesting to have you talk, maybe just a little bit, about the history of the American university in this sense. It is an institution that is special, unique. It's American universities are different from universities in other countries, although as the American university developed, particularly, I guess, in the 20th century, it borrowed some features and some ideas from higher education as it existed other places to make something that was different. Can you talk about that?
Yes, and I think it's actually a very interesting history. The beginning of the American research university actually takes place with the opening of Johns Hopkins University 100 years after the signing of the Declaration of Independence in 1876. So first of all, the American Research University has a relatively short history. But what does it grow out of? As you were suggesting, it grew out of a great admiration that American educational leaders had, for the German university system. The German university system in the early part of the 20th century dominated the quality institutions of the world. Göttingen and the University of Berlin were far and away the greatest research centers in the world, with the possible exception of Cambridge University and Oxford in England. But if you looked at the early awards of Nobel Prizes in this country in the first three decades of the 20th century, Germany dominated those prizes. The United States admired the research focus of the German universities, but also admired the undergraduate types of education that were delivered at Oxford and Cambridge. The American system really was an amalgam of these two traditions of education in Germany and in England. So we borrowed from the German system the research component, although we were not nearly as hierarchical in the way in which we organized ourselves. The laboratories were much more democratic and open compared to the hierarchical structure of the German system, and we borrowed the collegial system that we found in England. And then we grew it. I mean, and it took on its own character and became quite different in many ways from those systems which currently exist abroad. I would say that the turning point in the history of greatness comes with Hitler taking power in January 1933. That could be viewed as the tipping point between the end of the great German model and the beginning of the ascendancy of the American research universities. The purging of the Jewish scholars from German universities led to its rapid demise, and it gave a great impetus to American universities, especially because they were willing to take in and house some of the great intellectuals and scientists and scholars that came from Germany and places that were affected by the Nazi terror.
All right. We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone listening in Effingham. This is our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Thank you, David. I have a question and a statement. Has your guest ever heard of or read this question? I've had other times. Wilhelm Reich, who was extant in Germany in the very period you just articulated.
I've heard of him, yes.
You have? Okay. And you've not read him?
I haven't read his work.
You have?
No, I haven't read his work.
You haven't? Okay. Well, thank you. My statement is education across the board, around the world now, dominated by the West, has dumbed down the masses. And so long as that exists, we will have no such thing as democracy. We will have no such thing as higher education. The public schools, especially in the U.S., that dumb down the kids, and only those who are really interested accede into academic life and or science, as you've stated. And it's all about money. And that's my opinion. Thank you.
Well, you can react to that. Obviously, where the caller raises a number of issues and they go off into a number of directions, and some of them directly apply to what we're talking about and some don't. You feel free to respond to that any way, though, that you like.
Well, I think that, you know, it's needless to say there are many challenges that American educational systems face, especially in the K through 12 years. We're not producing anywhere near the number of youngsters who are trained well enough in science and technology to be able to take up positions in industry that are that need highly skilled and trained scientists and engineers. One of the great features of the American Research University is that we have been able over the years to, as it were, import the finest talent in the world who are actually dying to come to the United States to study at our great universities, who in the majority stay here in the United States and take up positions in universities, but as much as anything else in industry. And without that flow of talent, that brain drain that is coming into the United States, we would be hard-pressed to meet the demands that we find in industry, in high technology, for new innovative individuals. So I do think the caller has a point in saying that whether or not it's dumbing down, I wouldn't put it in those terms, but I do think that there is much that needs to be done to elevate the quality of our K through 12 educational systems. Now, if I were also allowed, permitted for a moment to indicate that state legislators most recently have suggested in wake of the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009 that they are cutting budgets for schooling and for universities. And I think that of all their choices, this is perhaps one of the worst that they can possibly make. I focus obviously on university funding, but there's also the cutting of funds to elementary and secondary schools that are very important. These are very narrow, short-sighted kinds of decisions, it seems to me, because these legislators very often don't realize the economic consequences of their actions. I mean, if I were to take, for example, the economic impact of Stanford University on its immediate surroundings, they have had over 2,400 companies that have been started by faculty members, students, or alumni of Stanford, and a subset of the industries that have been produced out of the discoveries made at Stanford not only include Google, but Cisco Systems, Hewlett-Packard, and this is responsible for about $255 billion worth of total revenue to the area around San Francisco, in the Bay Area, in 2008. Now, the same can be said, and even more perhaps, for MIT, and undoubtedly the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign is producing the kinds of work that is generating an enormous economic impact. University leaders don't do as much as they should to make the public aware of the consequences of cuts in the budgets of these universities for not only the students, but also for the economic welfare of their local communities.
Yeah. This is something that I know that people in education on all levels find very frustrating. And I realize that we're kind of talking in a circle here, but it does bring you back to the point that so often people who are involved in education at all levels are making the point that you cannot have a strong economy without strong schools. And somehow that message doesn't seem to be getting across in the state capitals across the country, or maybe it is, and for whatever reason the money just isn't going into schools.
Well, there are choices to be made. I mean, California is in the process of perhaps dismantling one of the greatest systems of public higher education in the history of the world, and they're obviously choosing to finance prisons more than they are their public higher universities. And that is a choice that has been mentioned by Governor Schwarzenegger, but doesn't mean it's going to be acted on, to shift the balance of resources in the state towards the productive uses that come out of universities, not only in terms of the human capital that's produced by the students of these universities who graduate from them, but also obviously from the extraordinary discoveries and the impact of those discoveries on national and local life.
Mm. Well, here in the – and I'm sure this is something that people listening to us will know – here in the state of Illinois, we have a budget crisis going that some people say is second only to that in California. I don't think it's gotten as much national attention, but it is a serious problem here, and it is affecting education in this state, and the universities are certainly affected. Here at this university, people are very concerned about the level of state support. We're talking about furloughs. We're talking about encouraging people to take early retirement. The thing that I think also concerns people, and this is it's difficult, more difficult to get a handle on because it's a conversation that's just gotten started. And that is 5 years from now, 10 years from now, what is the university going to look like? And I think that people here in the university administration are taking a very hard look at everything the university does. They're interested in economizing if that's possible. They have talked about shrinking the administrative level of the university. But also I think that they have said something like, we have to look at everything this university does and ask of every aspect of university activity, is this important? Is this what we should be doing? And I think there is this expectation that, again, in sometime in the future, 5 years, 10 years down the road, this university could well be smaller. Maybe not that it would have fewer students, but it could well have fewer administrators, maybe have fewer faculty. And there could be some programs that are being offered now and some classes that are being offered now that will not be here then. Do you think that that's something that we're going to be seeing with higher education across the country, that it will shrink?
Well, I think that there is a real possibility that it will shrink, and it may well be shrinking when the needs are actually growing. The numbers of students who are have access to these universities are actually expanding in number. But here's the real issue, I think. It's not so much as to whether or not there shouldn't be accountability by these universities as to whether or not their activities are meaningful, whether they're really contributing to the education of students, whether they're productive in terms of the kinds of knowledge that they are producing. That ought to be done at universities as a matter of course. And universities have not been particularly good at, shall I say, winding down programs that turn out not to be very productive. So I think universities should be doing that, and I don't think there's any problem with that. The real question is, what is going to go, and what are the consequences for these universities, like the University of Illinois, which is a great, great university with a great history? Well, the problems are that state universities are facing in California, in Illinois, in Arizona, in Wisconsin and Michigan, is that they are in the middle of a highly competitive system. Will they lose the best of their faculty? Will they begin to lose the best of their students to their competitors? I mean, while we're sympathetic, many of us are sympathetic to the plight that the universities are facing or potentially facing with cuts, the same universities that are being sympathetic are out there like vultures trying to feed on these universities to pick off the most talented researchers, the most talented scientists and scholars, and usher them out of the state and into their own university domains. Now, that could lead to a real loss in quality of these institutions, and that would be a really tragic result. What legislators at most states simply do not understand is that once you have reduced or sacrificed qualities of these universities, once you have dismantled them in terms of their productive capabilities, it is infinitely harder to rebuild and regain that quality than to sustain it, and it will cost a lot more to do so. The cascading consequences of the loss of that quality in terms of the economics of the state, who lives there, the quality of life within the state, are huge and are really generally unexamined by the legislators, at least as they face these financially difficult times.
We are a little bit past our midpoint in this hour of Focus 580. My name is David Inge, and our guest is Jonathan Cole. He is well known throughout the country for the 14 years that he spent as provost and dean of faculties at Columbia University. He held the position as the university's chief academic officer for the second longest tenure in the 254-year history of the university. He currently is the John Mitchell Mason Professor at Columbia, and he is the author of a book that explores this territory that we're discussing here this morning. The title of his book is The Great American University, Its Rise to Preeminence, Its Indispensable National Role, and Why It Must Be Protected. It's published by Public Affairs. Questions are welcome. Questions, comments, certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to phone in, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have some other callers here. We'll talk next with someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. I would suggest that this loss of faculty will go even farther than to other universities in this country. At present, the University of Illinois has top faculty professors who come from all over the world, particularly India, Pakistan, Taiwan, Korea. And these people, if they don't come here as undergrads, are going to be less likely to stay. And if our salaries are not competitive with those in Europe or even in their home countries, we're going to lose, I would estimate, 5 to 10% of our best faculty. And that will have a horrendous effect upon our economy.
Well, I think you have a very good point, actually. I mean, we recruit an awful lot of talent from around the world. And in fact, the flow of talent is such that perhaps higher education in this country is the only industry which today has a favorable balance of trade. If we start undermining these universities, cutting back on the resources that are available to them, we're not going to be as competitive as we have been in the past with what other universities in other nations can actually offer these individuals. At the moment, we still, in fact, offer much higher salaries than those which are obtainable, for example, in France or in Germany or Italy or in the United Kingdom. This has led, of course, to a flow of talent to us. But if we should severely cut back on the resources available, I think the gentleman has a point that this is going to produce a lot of people staying at home rather than coming to the United States. That would have very severe consequences on the qualities of these institutions as well.
The very instability of employment here and the moves by some people to do away with academic tenure, these all make employment here less inviting. And I don't think the general public understands this. There's quite a strong animosity toward tenure in particular. And I think
well,
it's very
I think,
important.
I think that also is a good point. I think academic tenure has many functions, not least of which is to protect individuals to pursue lines of inquiry that they really want to pursue. It's led to a tremendous amount of discovery that's of great value to the country. So the issue of tenure is certainly a matter of some concern. I think also visa policies in the United States in recent years have been highly restrictive and have led very talented young people in Asian societies, particularly in China and elsewhere, to have great difficulty coming to the United States despite the fact that they very much want to study here or work here. To the extent that we put up barriers, as it were, intellectual trade barriers with other countries, it's going to become increasingly difficult to get the talent from the world that we have gotten over the last 25 or 30 years to continue to flow to the United States.
Mm-hmm. I think that's an interesting and important point, that it has become more difficult for people from other countries to come to study at American universities. And, you know, perhaps some people might say something like, well, why should we be providing the education for people that then will leave the country and will go home and then will become competitors of the United States? I think that it is true that a healthy percentage of people who come from other countries to the United States to do graduate work and probably end up with PhDs, many of them actually end up staying in the United States. They don't leave to become competitors. They stay to become part of the American economy.
There's no question about that, David. I mean, if you look on the most recent statistics that I've seen of those Chinese nationals who come to study in the United States at the PhD level, roughly 90% of those who receive PhDs stay in the United States rather than going home. It's not that they're disloyal to their country or that they don't love their countries, but the opportunities here have been far greater than they could achieve in China. There are opportunities to make important new discoveries, to advance knowledge in various ways, to teach at institutions that have extraordinary students, have in fact been greater here. To the extent that our visa policies become far more restrictive and difficult, as they certainly were during the Bush administration, I think we have some real potential problems in our hands in trying to continue this flow of talent to the United States.
I have some callers here, and I promise I will get to them. We'll try to get in as many as we can. I do want to work in an email question because it just touches on what we're just talking about. I have someone who poses this question. They're interested in the percentage of foreign students that come to U.S. universities, how that compares with past years. And the observation is that it was their sense that it probably has increased. That would also mean increased tuition money for schools, and whether in fact you feel that schools are, you know, how schools are thinking about the percentage of foreign students, and the fact that that will mean some increased revenue, because I suppose the same thing applies to students who come from who are Americans but come from out of state. Now, that does mean an increase in revenue.
Yes, and I think that there has been some effort by many colleges and universities in the country to increasingly recruit undergraduates from abroad, because they tend to pay full tuition and are generally, except at the most wealthy of institutions, that are not offered the same kind of financial aid as students from within the United States. So I do think there has been an effort to increase the internationalization. I think some of it is motivated by very good ideals, which is to increase the flow of talented students around the world, where many of our colleges and universities want to see our own students go abroad and have experiences abroad during their undergraduate years. But I do think that some of the financial constraints on colleges and universities in the country today have led them to increase the numbers of undergraduate students who come from abroad. Now, for graduate students at major research universities, most of them are fully financed. So there's no real increase in revenues from tuition that come from increasing the number of foreign graduate students in the United States. In fact, universities more often have to pay for those graduate students than themselves than, for example, the National Science Foundation or the National Institutes might pay for them, since they're not citizens.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's go to some other callers. Indianapolis next, line 4.
Hi.
Hello.
Interesting program. This kind of touches on something that Mr. Inge brought up earlier, but I was wondering about percentages of, like, within a particular state. Let's say that, you know, 80% of the students who go to a university stay there. I wonder if you have any data on that. You know, if you can draw students to your state for education, what is the likelihood that they stay to work there? If you've already touched on that, I missed it, but you kind of talked about it with regard to China, but I wonder, you know, from state to state. And also, I'd kind of like to see the flip side of that, of places, states in particular in the United States, where a shift in educational policy has shown some kind of dramatic migration into or out of the state, you know, long term, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a very
Yeah, go ahead.
Very interesting question, and I think that there's no question, although I'd be hard-pressed to give you exact statistics here, that those states that maintain very robust educational establishments within their own borders tend to attract talented, well-educated, highly proficient individuals. For example, Massachusetts does this. California certainly has done it. I think that New York does it to some extent, and I think Illinois has done that as well. To the extent that there is an underfinancing and a withdrawal of financial aid, I think you do potentially have a limit on the numbers of talented people moving into the state and actually staying there. I think there's another problem that we have to talk about, and that is – and that was suggested, I think, in David's earlier question, and that is that, you know, one of the great, great attributes of American state public education has been the effort to open up access to talented students within its state – to provide them with opportunities for growth and to move up the ladders of social mobility within their state through the educational system provided, particularly the state universities. Now, access and excellence are difficult to maintain, but they are essential for great state universities. And Illinois has got to do that as well. To the extent that young people have their access closed, they're going to go elsewhere. To the extent that Illinois needs more money for its higher educational system and they begin to recruit out-of-staters because they're full payers, that may reduce the access available to in-state youngsters in Illinois who could very much benefit by the great state university system there. So that is another hazard that the states face and that I don't think they have fully taken into account in making the choices that they have about financing higher education.
We have about 10 minutes left, a little bit less. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Jonathan Cole. He is currently the John Mitchell Mason Professor at Columbia University and is author of the recently published book, The Great American University, Its Rise to Preeminence, Its Indispensable National Role, Why It Must Be Protected. It's published by Public Affairs Books. We have some other callers here, and we will go to the next in line. That's someone in Bloomington, Illinois, line 3. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Hi. Yes, thank you for taking my call. My question and comments, I guess, go back to the guest's comments before and after the caller who mentioned somebody by the name of William Reich. And I guess the underlying point in my call is that we can't really understand, not to mention address, the situation of K-20 education in the U.S., without really going back to the historical and political economic context of education and schooling, and going back, you know, hundreds of years. And the guest mentioned the U.S., particularly higher education system, being an amalgamation of education in Germany and in Britain, and seemed to credit that as a real strength of the American education system. And while I think strengths have come out of that, I also think it's partly our difficulty in solving and addressing our problem, because it's not that I know a ton about it, but I think the German education system, why the university system is so able to focus on research and really discipline-based preparation for ways of making a living that require higher education, is because it has a diversified secondary education system that is an education system, but that provides apprenticeship education combined with what we call liberal arts education to really prepare people for a diversity of ways of making a living, and are resourced and informed by all those industries that play a role in paying for that and taking on apprentices. And that system, because our educational system history comes more via Britain, that apprenticeship-based education process was really decimated in Britain before our American history started. And we have to achieve in college what Germany is achieving in their college preparatory schools. And so we repeat at the collegiate level, like I think Britain does, what can be accomplished and should be accomplished at the secondary level, as well as the secondary level having education that people who don't need to go on to college to really make a very good living. And that's the other place where the political economic context comes in, because if you have a system where the social net and the benefits, the health insurance, the 6 weeks paid vacation is across the board for anybody who has a decent living, has a job, then you can, you know, the gaps of income earning that are achieved by college and higher education are mitigated, I think. So I guess I'm sorry there's not really a question embedded there, but I will hang up and listen to the guests' responses to those comments.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, I think that our guests make some interesting historical points, but I think they're mostly historical. Things have changed greatly in Europe. For one, the age in which there were the great preparation of a limited number of students is basically gone in Europe. The opening up of the educational system to the masses for mass education has occurred in the last 35 or 40 years. And while you have educational secondary school systems, which are very good in Germany and in England and to some extent in France as well, it hasn't translated into powerful university systems. In fact, there's not one university in the top 50 in the world that comes in Germany today. There's not one in the top 75 that is Russian today. So the fact that you have a lot of preparation in the secondary schools doesn't necessarily translate into great strength in the university system. The United States, when I was suggesting, had some of its historical roots in Germany and in England. It's not as if we didn't add something to it ourselves. And that was to have far greater open access much earlier for many students to obtain college educations. This is only a recent phenomenon, actually, in Europe, in France, and in Germany. So it's true, as our caller said, that there are many problems with preparation of students who are going into the community colleges and state colleges, as well as private institutions. But we also have an extraordinary number of very gifted and very talented youngsters going into the system today who can do advanced work fairly early on. And we're not really involved in remedial education at that level. I'm not trying to negate the point that there is much that needs to be done in K-12 in the United States to prepare our students adequately in many areas, like I was suggesting, science and technology is certainly two of those areas that needs to be done in order to improve the quality of that system, and that would have an enormous impact on the nation.
All right. We have a couple callers remaining. We don't have very much time, but we'll go on and get at least one more, hopefully both, to line number two next. Hello.
Hi. I think the problem also extends beyond what you're saying to something more far-reaching, and that is the emphasis of a lot of political folks on reducing taxes and on individuals as opposed to what we can accomplish as a community, as a nation, as a state. Bush said, we're giving your money back to you, so you can decide how to spend it. You don't get good education, you don't get good social services, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, if we don't accomplish this as communities. And I think we need to, all as citizens, challenge people when they say that in letters to the editor, in call-in shows, et cetera. And a lot of legislators are afraid to pay for what we need by raising taxes because they know that will be used against them in elections. And for some people, that's the only thing that is important to them is taxes. if we have a tax system set up so that if you don't have a job, you don't get taxed very much, obviously you don't get income tax. We should be pointing these things out to people, and we should be saying, you know, if we've got the resources, if I as an individual have more resources, I should be billing up to the bar and paying more to help the community I'm benefiting from survive and do well. And we need to state those things as overarching things to all that you're talking about. So that's my comment. Thanks.
All right.
Well, I think it's a very good point, and I happen to agree with you. I think that if we can demonstrate that the taxpayers' dollars are going to be spent in highly productive ways for individuals as well as the community, then we ought to really be willing to consider the possibility of increasing the tax rates, the marginal tax rates, in order to pay for some of these kinds of extraordinarily productive forces in our society. So I actually agree with your comment.
Well, we'll try to get one more caller in Champaign here on line number one. I'll have to ask you to be brief, but please go ahead.
Okay. My question is just, because the cost of higher education, particularly if you look at things like medical school or law school, some types of specialized graduate education, has just become almost prohibitive for so many people. What do you think are the impacts of that on funneling more people and getting more people that eventually will go into these universities as researchers and such? And what do you think, is there a solution to this cost that's becoming so outrageously high?
And I can give you about a minute there, Professor Cole.
Yeah. Well, I think it's an extremely important point. We have to improve the access to financial aid. We have to improve the government's level of financing of higher education, whether they be through Pell Grants, whether they be through Stafford and cheap loans. There's no question that if education becomes prohibitively expensive for the middle class, we are going to be in very difficult straits. And there isn't any question as well that the middle class is being pinched these days in terms of the cost of higher education. The very wealthiest colleges and universities can give very, very steep financial aid discounts for students who are admitted. But for most people who find themselves in the middle class, it's very difficult. And we really that's a great investment, financial aid. It's a wonderful way of producing more productive people in our society.
There we'll have to leave it. The book is The Great American University. It's published by Public Affairs Books, just out. Our guest, the author, Jonathan Cole. He is the John Mitchell Mason Professor at Columbia University. Professor Cole, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure to be with you, David.